This is Virginia Cornett. I'm the oral history chairperson for the Louisville unit of the Women's Overseas Service League. I'm interviewing Virginia Emmerich, E-M-R-I-C-H, Emmerich. Today's date is May 4th, 1983. Virginia, what branch of service did you serve in?
I was with the American Red Cross in club work.
Okay. First, would you like to give a little bit of biographical data about yourself?
I was born and raised here in Louisville and went to school, the high school and the University of Louisville. And I was working during the war as a secretary to the Graduate Division of Social Administration when across my desk came several brochures from the American Red Cross recruiting women to go overseas. And I had a brother who'd already, one brother had already entered the Air Force as a pilot in China, Burma, and India, and another brother who was a flight surgeon with the Air Force in England. So I decided I wanted to get into the war effort, but I didn't want to be on an assembly line, and I chose Red Cross to apply to. And then I did apply, and they accepted my application to the point they said, come up to Alexandria, Virginia for an interview. And I didn't tell my present boss that where I was going, just asked for the time off, because I didn't believe I'd be accepted. And I didn't want to come back and hang in my head. But I spent one whole day of interviews up there, and they knew more about me when I finished than I had ever known about myself. In fact, at 5 o'clock, when most of the staff was leaving up there, they set me in the reception hall and asked me to wait, and then they would give me their answer to my application. And when the young lady came to get me, take me back in the office, she pointed out that I was holding up a magazine upside down, which I didn't even know. I thought I'd been reading at that time. But they did accept me, providing I would pass my physical, but I could not stay over for a physical that day. And they said, well, we'll let you go home, get a physical, not from your father. My father was a physician. But someone outside of the family, send the results to us. They had a form they gave me, and then we will pass on that. I did pass the physical and was notified to come to Washington, D.C. on December the 13th. Well, I hated that. It was so close to Christmas. It was 1943, and I'd already planned for Christmas, so I begged off, but no. They said, you must come with this group that will be in class soon. So off I went to Washington, D.C., and they put me up at the American University, which then was the operating class, our school, for orientation to Red Cross girls. And it was mostly lectures, and gave us some idea what to expect, but it really wasn't very factual. We found out after we got overseas, it took just practical knowledge to apply on the job after we got there. But after the 2 weeks when we received our uniforms and had nothing other than theory given to us, I was put in an embassy club in Washington, D.C. The embassy club had been an embassy once upon a time, a big old house, and the Red Cross girls who were on temporary duty were put there to run it, like a club that they might run overseas. We had to do everything but the cleaning. We had to buy the food, fix the meals. Also, it was set up as a service club in that at certain hours during the day, servicemen just passing by could drop in, and we were to treat them the way we would if they'd come into our recreation hall on some base or camp. I was there 2 weeks, and the furnace broke down, so I had to go back to the campus, and they sent me out to Camp Pickett at Blackstone, Virginia, supposedly on temporary duty, and got down there 2 days, and they said, come on back, we're sending you out on assignment. But back to Washington I went, and they said, you're going to Europe. And I said, I did not ask to go to Europe. I wanted to go to the Pacific. Well, you're going to Europe. So I went to the East Coast staging area, and I was still calling on the telephone and calling headquarters and talking to people and saying, no, no, no. I was headed the wrong direction. Finally, on Saturday, I guess about January the 10th, something of that sort, they said, okay, you're coming back to Washington. But my footlocker went to Europe. And I had some more temporary duty in Washington until finally headed across country to San Francisco on a train with 40 Red Cross women, men and women, both. And I knew I was headed in the right direction. We had 4 days in San Francisco, in which time we were free, but we were told every 4 hours to report back in case they decided to ship us out fast and didn't know where we were. So we had much freedom. It was wonderful sightseeing. But every 4 hours we did call back. I spent an awful lot of those 4 days, though, rolling and re-rolling my bedroll. It didn't pass inspection. Each Red Cross girl was given a bedroll, and in that we could put certain items of our clothing. Now, but mine was always too lumpy, too bulky, and just too much of everything, it seemed like. So I had roll, re-roll, and it went on for days before they really accepted and said, okay, we'll ship it out for you now. When we did leave from San Francisco, and we were told we were going to be taken down the boat, and not to call anybody, not to let any, I had relatives there in Los Angeles that I had been talking to over the telephone, but not to call them. It was all very hush-hush, and we were going out the back part of the hotel, which was the Sir Francis Drake Hotel, where they had put us up, and they were going to put us on a bus with the curtain pulled down and everything. So we went down the supply elevators, and down there were the buses parked at the back door, but there also were hundreds of people waving goodbye, goodbye, good luck. So it wasn't a big secret at all that they tried to tell us it was going to be. And when we got to the boat, you laugh at this, but I prayed that this was long before the job, the serious part of it, of course. I prayed that I would faint so that they would carry me on, because I was the only one in winter clothing, because my suitcase had gone to Europe, and in Washington, D.C., it was cold and icy. I had winter uniform on. I had a musette bag on one shoulder, the regular uniform bag on the other, a carton of records in one hand, and a portable typewriter in the other. And then I was loaded down, and I was hot and miserable in San Francisco. When I got in, we stood in line, like everybody else, just stood in line for hours, got up to the check point. They said, show me your pass. Well, it was on the inside pocket of my coat. I had to get the tallest girl in line to get on my inside coat and pull it out. We got aboard ship, and we were on ship, which was the Matsonia, and it had been a luxury liner before, which went from California to Hawaii, but it was made over into a troop ship, and I was put in to a stateroom that had 6 people in it, and being one of the smallest, I got one of the top bunks, of course, too, but I got lucky as time went on, because 2 of the women in that room got sick and were in the sick bay the whole trip over, so I got one of the lower bunks eventually. And actually, we didn't spend much time in our stateroom because it was over the boiler room. It was both hot and noisy. So we were given the freedom of mixing with the officers, and during the day we could play games, sit down on the deck with them and such. That only one objection I had a friend who was not an officer, who was aboard that ship. He was an enlisted man. And I was not allowed to go and talk to him he was not allowed to come up to the deck where I was, and I objected to this very much, but I didn't know whom to go to register this complaint. But we decided, through signaling more or less, we'd attend all the religious services on that boat, and that way we'd get together and talk, and that's the way we managed it. Something else, which was a first for me, I was waiting to see the Southern Cross appear at nighttime, and they allowed the women to sleep out on deck at nighttime on one side and the men on the other. Only nobody had told me that you got up early in the morning. If you didn't, you got to hose down, because the Navy got out and swabbed it and cleaned the deck with their hoses, and they announced it, they said, but I don't think it was at their loudest, because they took great joy the first time in turning the hoses on us. We all went down below sopping wet, but we learned, and it didn't happen a second time. When we arrived, we were given orders not to open them until we were mid-sea. So we opened up, said, you will go to Sydney, Australia. Oh, fine, the biggest city in Australia, that's great. But we landed instead at Brisbane, Australia. Why, we never did know. But we had gone out in convoy when the ship left, and it was a very zigzaggy journey. And we had some boats accompanying us partway, and then they just disappeared. No, and then we were on our own. And somehow or other, the boats then left for different destinations, and ours went into Brisbane. Australia, of course, was quite different to me, and I might as well have been a foreigner, though I spoke English. They were supposed to speak English, too. But when we got there, we didn't have immediate assignments, and we were told to visit as many servicemen clubs as we could find, and the type of work being done for servicemen that we might end up doing. In wandering around Brisbane, I was stopped once by an Australian woman who said, do you have any fashion magazines? We'd love to have fashion magazines. Well, I didn't have any. Then another time I was stopped by he said he was a reporter, he had a camera. He said, what are those things you're wearing on your head? And at the moment I really don't remember the name of them, but it was a rain, part of our rain gear, to fit, to fit over our hats. And so he took a picture of the three of us. There were two other Red Cross girls, and it did appear in the newspaper over there, and we got a copy later on. And finally, I was assigned to a beautiful beach hotel, which the Red Cross had taken over as a club for the officers of Navy and Air Force and Infantry, but they came to us on order for the most part. They came after a hospital leave. They were on a convalescent leave, or they came out of battle from some of the islands close by, or some such thing as that. There were a few men who came regularly because they worked in MacArthur's headquarters, which he was based at Brisbane at that time. And these men had access to come to the club, because we did have a dining room, we served meals, we had our own private beach. We had a music room. We had facilities like a country club. It was just set up beautifully there. And I was a staff assistant, which was the lowest of the low at that time. And I did everything, literally, and I loved it. Got kind of hard. I didn't know how to do a lot of things, but I learned because it was expected of me. There was another installation about 3 miles down the coast at Southport, Australia. And our two staffs got together, our two Red Cross staffs got together once a week and made out the recreational program for the men. We tried not to duplicate anything so that the men staying at one of the installations would participate in what we had up in Southport and what was going on down in Circus Paradise. Then we would go down there for their events. So we worked very well together that way, and that way we had many more recreational type of things.
Some of the types of things you offered.
What was a typical recreational program for 1 week?
Well, I might start at the beginning of a day. One of them, this sounds peculiar, but we had a third house that was called Ludoma, L-U-D-O-M-A, in which there was a kitchen, kind of like a Dutch kitchen. And if any of the men didn't get down to breakfast on time, it was the Red Cross girls' duty to go and fix them a little breakfast of some sort, whatever we had on it. It might be just toast and coffee or tea, or once in a while we'd get hold of an egg or something of that sort. And that was a chatty, nice, relaxed moment in the morning. We had bicycles. We could go about 14 miles on flat land, and that was as much as most of us could make on bicycles anyway. And then we had access to horses. We had a nice group of riding horses and trails to ride over. We had access to a golf course, a short golf course, not 18 holes. I think it was 9 holes. And we had access to tennis courts there in the town. The beach, of course, was always there with guards on duty, that is, American Army guards on duty most of the day. We had a river which was about half a mile away from Surface Paradise, and we chartered boats there for boat rides, particularly night rides were so enjoyable. And we went to a little island where we would have hot dog roast and marshmallow roast and that sort of thing. We invited the girls from the neighboring town to come for these events. Also, every Saturday night, the Navy Club, which was one block away and had the plush hotel in the area already, allowed us to use their dance hall facilities. So they furnished the band, we furnished the girls, and we spent all day Saturday making sandwiches and hors d'oeuvres, and also everyone we could get hold of flyers, corsages for the young ladies that we had invited from the town through the mayor. And of course, the usual thing. You play cribbage, play games with them, sew their insignia on them, write letters for them if they couldn't, or just sit and talk to them. And once in a while, we got a bus together and went to neighboring towns that had some interest to site, historical site, something that sort. I had one day a week off. And most of the time, or I wouldn't say most of the time, but half the time I stayed right there at the beach because I enjoyed the beach so much. But there came a time when I myself became a patient in the base hospital. I'd caught a cold going cross country in the United States, which stayed with me all the way through to got to Australia. In Australia, then it settled in with sore throats and earaches and such things as that, and soon I found that I was having eustachian tube problems. So I would go into Brisbane every so often for checkups, and they were trying to take care of my allergies as well as this cold as well as eustachian tube. In Brisbane, where General MacArthur was established, I got to meet his wife, his son, the Ama, and the general, and they came as guests to the club whenever the general had to go down the coastline to visit some of the other army and well, they were events going on and camps set up for things that we were not supposed to know about for future invasion purposes. But Mrs. MacArthur and her son would drop out of the car when General MacArthur came by and come into and the AMA, come into the club, and we would give them dressing rooms, and they would go down and spend most of the day on the beach. They would eat there, but that was one of the enjoyable moments of being there at the camp. These men who came to these two places, and I did work in both of them. I was at I was at Southport about 3 months, and then I was sent down to Surface Paradise after that, because I was needed there more when the girls, the staff members had left. We also had the Admiral Halsey drop in for a dance. I had a chance to see a lot of the people who really had been in the battle, because we were told not to discuss battle with our men. Most of them didn't want to talk about it. They wanted to talk about it. And so I really knew very little, or the, I would say all Red Cross personnel there knew very little about what was going on up the islands. And we had to work, and our hours were about, our duty was about 12 hours duty. That we did take a time to change our clothes in the afternoon and freshen up for the nighttime duties. And we did eat in the club when they had very good food, so we weren't strict on that at all. In March and April, there was a push up to Hollandia.
Is that, what year was that, Virginia? March, April?
It's still 1944. And all the men were called in from the clubs. So the Red Cross personnel were left high and dry, and we started doing a few things on our own. And one of the surprises I got, when the director of Surface Paradise Club, Red Cross personnel, who was Lady Coop, Emily Coop, and I learned to love her. I met her back in Washington, went over on the ship with her, and was assigned with her. She and I went to the cinema down about a block away from the club, just for something to do. And their cinema was quite different. It was almost like an open-air thing with just a tent over it and seats that you sat in, your knees came up and met your chin, practically. And it was very cold, because this was the beginning of the cold time over there. Lady Coot and I were sitting watching the news reel, and there we appeared on the news. When we were in Red Cross, at the American University class, Madeline Carroll, the movie star, also was in that class. And the papers got word that she was there, and they burst into the classroom, disrupted it, wearing Madeline. They were rude and rough and everything else. So the teachers and the Red Cross personnel, which were following behind them, got them out of the room, made a bargain with them, that if Madeline Carroll gave them a half a day of her time, would they leave her alone the rest of the time she was there? She was just like anybody else. She was a Red Cross person being trained for overseas work. And it was agreeable with both parties. Well, they sat Madeline up in the front row. She wasn't up there, and I happened to be in the front row myself, though. And so they took the pictures of facing the class, and there I was, and Lady Coop was close behind us. So we yelled and screamed. There were so few of us in the show at that time. Stop the picture, stop the picture, and all. They didn't. But afterwards, I went up and talked to the man running the motion picture reel, asked if we could get a picture of that or a clip of it or something. He said he'd try, but we never did. But Madeline Carroll, to go on with her story that day, she was very gracious to them. She did everything they wanted her to do. They wanted her in uniform. Well, we hadn't been issued uniforms. So one of the Red Cross supervisors took off her uniform so Madeline could put one on and pose in it. It wasn't a good fit, but it was good enough. Also, they wanted Madeline packing her suitcase, or packing her, no, the biggest thing, a trunk. They wanted something new. Well, she didn't have a trunk, but they grabbed somebody else's trunk, and they used it as props and took pictures of Madeline doing all these things, which was normal sometime or other, but not at that time. They'd been faked up and all. But anyway, that was a moment of rest and leisure that we remembered at that time. On Tuesday, June the 6th, the radio announced that the Second Front was opened in the invasion of northern France. Well, that, of course, meant something to us. We felt kind of closer to the whole world war at that time. The people working on the other side as well as those people in the Pacific who were fighting. And it was extremely cold. That was the month of June. And they didn't have central heating down there. And I had asked to go to the Pacific because I do not like cold weather. Well, their sharp winter is very severe, though, I found out, and we managed. By the way, I was wearing all Australian Red Cross uniform at this time because I still did not have my footlocker. And but I managed to pass the muster from the American Red Cross office. They said, oh, it was all right for me to wear what they saw me wearing there. And another little note of item, one day, this was July the 15th, 1944, I went into a bookshop in Southport, and there I saw a book written by a former teacher of mine, Boyd Morton, who was head of the theater department at the University of Louisville. He'd written a book called American Drama and Stage, and a bookshop had, and so I bought one, and of course I let everybody in the bookstore know that I knew the man, and it sort of made a celebrity of me. Anyway, I sent that copy back to Boyd Martin, and he was very interested in where it came from. I think he saved the wrapping and the postmark, and he thought more of that than he did receiving a copy of his own book again. But he got a kick out of it. And all that time I was still troubled with my ear. I was fighting that because I ended up, I might as well say, in deafness in one ear as a result of my service overseas. Another event that occurred that might be interesting to recall is that Marge Dowling, who was a Red Cross girl, had become engaged to Bill McMaster, who was an Army officer. But Bill was, at the time they set their wedding date, Bill happened to be in the midst of battle in one of the islands up in the Pacific. But Marge went ahead and made plans. She borrowed a wedding dress from an Australian girl. I borrowed a bridesmaid outfit, because I was going to be the bridesmaid, from an Australian girl. And Bill was going to bring his best man. When he arrived, they went to the cathedral, the Catholic cathedral there in Brisbane, and said they wanted to be married the next day. They'd set the next day. The priest said, all right, we'll do it. It's your service people, and this is something unusual, and we'll do it without a mass or any big, just your party, and such as that. Now, let me see your orders. Bill said, oh, I have no orders. No, you have no written orders. No, I came right out of battle, and I was given a word-of-mouth consent. Well, we can't marry you. Well, I went to the phone immediately and called everything off, called all the people who were coming to the wedding, and I said, sit tight until I find out what's going to happen, but the service is off this morning. And also had to call the people who were baking the cake, and I said, I think maybe you better go ahead and bake the cake, but I don't know when to tell you to deliver it. And called the house that where we had decorated the hall, and said, we want you to keep that hall for us all day long if you can, because this wedding at the moment is being held up. So Bill McMask, his bride to be and myself went to the cable office, and Bill started cabling back up the line to get permission to find his exact officer who was in battle up there and have him cable something that were orders for the marriage. It took about 4 hours. It's just sitting there and pumping cables back here, there, back and ashes and so on and so forth. Finally, Bill had a piece of paper, and we went to the priest, and I got to the telephone again and told everybody to come on immediately to the wedding, called everything else, said it's just postponed by 4 hours, but it's on again. They came. We had the, but we didn't have time. The priest said, well, you've got to get here before such and such, because I have something else definitely planned. She did not have time to put her wedding dress on. I did not have time to get into my bridesmaid dress, so we were both in our American Red Cross uniform at her wedding. And we had a very short ceremony, went back to the house, all reception. And then I went back to the club at Surfers Paradise, and a few days later found out that one of the three buildings which the Red Cross ran for servicemen was to be turned over to nurses, WACs, Red Cross women who would come from New Guinea and other places around on leave. So now we were serving the women as well as the men. And also in August, the same month, my footlocker arrived, and it was just like Christmas when I opened it up, because I had forgotten so many of the things that I had put into it. And I could get into the official Red Cross uniform now and discard the Australian Red Cross uniform. At that time, also, General MacArthur and his wife and son were still visiting the clubs and using our beaches. And he was still working with training troops down at a place called Bow Desert. These men were going into what was they were told was hazardous service. But slowly, all the men were moving north into battle and getting ready for the Philippines invasion, which took place October the 20th. And I remember on the day after the Philippines had been invaded and we got the word about it, that Captain Lanny Ross, who was in special services, came down to attend a dance that we had at San Susi and to spend a week there on leave. He was a very interesting person and a very nice personality, easy to get to know and get along with. And when he returned to Brisbane, where he was based at that time, he offered me a ride as I was going into the hospital for treatment of my ear. And it was a memorable ride because he sang songs just for the pure love of it and the joy of singing on our way to Brisbane. And in later on that month, I was rewarded with a leave. And so I went down to Sydney for 1 week where I visited various Red Cross girls that I had come over from the United States with and knew they were based down there. And while I was enjoying myself down there, I met we called ourselves relatives, but we couldn't figure out exactly where the ties were, but met a yeoman, Steve Emmerich, Jr. He was from Cleveland, Ohio. And being a sailor, of course, one of the joys for him was to take a ride on this very large sailboat out in the harbor at Sydney, and he asked me to go along. That was my first experience at sailboat riding.
I had no idea you moved as often as you did on sailboats. When I returned to work at Surfers Paradise, I became conscious of an anti-aircraft training school, which was down the beach several miles from us, because their guns were booming, their searchlights were playing at night, and planes were flying, and some of them carrying targets, and realized that very shortly these men would be put into battle beyond the Philippines even. And on November the 23rd, when the Army celebrated its Thanksgiving Day, it was kind of a farewell party also, because the men realized that they would not be stationed close by, or would not be sent back to Australia on leaves very shortly. And I also, at the end of that month, received word that I would be sent to Darwin, Australia, up in the Northern Territory, and I began to be outfitted in GI attire. I wondered why, but after I got up to Darwin, I realized how necessary that garb was. And on November the 30th, we had another Thanksgiving Day celebrate, and that was the Navy's Day. For some reason or other, they couldn't quite agree, but we enjoyed having double celebrations. And at that time, I ran into a boy who had been a neighbor of mine for several years, who was in the Navy and came down to celebrate the Navy's Thanksgiving Day at their hotel. And that particular time, we had a dance also at the Navy Club in honor of the Thanksgiving Day. And I went with John, and not as a date, but because we could not have dates at the time of the dances, but he just came down and escorted me about a block from my house to the Navy Club. And I had an unfortunate experience, because he opened a gate for me and I caught my finger in it, and I had a smashed finger for about 2 weeks. On Wednesday, December the 6th, 1944, I left San Susi and Udoma and Southport and Surfers Paradise, and flew by Qantas to Darwin, Australia. We started out about 5:45 in the morning and arrived up there about 6:15. We stopped once to gas up, I guess. I don't really know why. I believe we did pick up a passenger somewhere along the line there. And based in Darwin were the 49th Air Depot Group, the 528th Squadron, 380th Bomb Group was close by, and the Naval Base 245. And I was assigned to the Navy Recreation Hall, which consisted of two Quonset huts and put together in form of an L. And there were about 315 men on the base, and they had formerly had a Red Cross girl running the rec hall, but she had become engaged to an Australian officer and returned to the United States to be married. But they'd been without anybody in their rec hall for quite some time, and in the meantime, the men had let their beard grow. They'd given up wearing shirts. They cut off their trousers and wore real baggy looking things, and generally kind of let themselves go in appearance. Well, when I went to work at the club, unbeknownst to me though, the Navy commander decided that all the beards had to be shaven, that shirts would be worn except when they were working, and no more cutting off their trousers, and in other words, to shape up. I was blamed for this for a while, but I could finally convince the boys I had nothing to do with it at all. I hadn't expressed any opinions about it, but it was just their commander's idea. The Quonset huts were divided up into active places and not so active places. That is, one of the Quonset huts had the table games and pool games and various things of that sort, whereas in the other Quonset hut we had a library, we had a Victrola, the crank-up type, and records to play, and the sit-down games, and the counter where Joe, their expression for coffee, was served, and whenever we could get it, Coca-Cola or Cargill, and once in a while, popcorns and such things as that. The men there on the Navy base, for the most part, had seen service of various types. They were based at Darwin to service ships and submarines that would come in. There was a mine assembly depot there from which the ships could be serviced with the ammunition that was needed. Also, there were parts for the ships. And there were men who were trained to apply these parts and to repair the ships, that sort of thing. Also, there were a group of men who, for one reason or other, had been unhappy in service, that had trouble. Some of them had been behind bars and had been troublemakers, and so they were put there at bay. After I was there about 6 weeks, one of the commanders told me that he was going to send me a treat, not just myself, but the three girls, the three Red Cross girls with whom I lived, also a treat, because of the handling of the men that had been troublemakers, who now seemed to be much happier and of a more peaceful nature. And he gave me the benefit of that. I don't really know, but I tried hard to keep things going that were exciting as much as possible in the rec halls by different competitions, by sharing things with all of us. And the treat that he sent us was breakfast in bed. One morning, he told us that he was going to send some men over with the breakfast in bed. So earlier, the three Red Cross girls and I got up and prettied ourselves up, put on our best robes, etc., and makeup and such. And pretty soon, the Jeep came with food and trays, covers for the food. It was really quite fancy, flour on each tray. And so we jumped, we'd been out of bed, we jumped back in bed and let the corpsmen serve us, and then they took off, went back to the kitchen or whatever. And we got out of bed, brought our food into a center room, which is the core of the house where we live, and had breakfast together after they'd gone. Another treat that one of the other commanders sent to me, in appreciation for what he expressed as good work in the rec hall, he sent me a box full of cosmetic things such as hair shampoo and special kind of scented soaps, hand lotion, the sort of things that certainly could not get up there. And I later found out that this commander had written to his wife and asked her to send these things over to him. And it was certainly a welcome treat. One of the first projects I had to undertake when I got up in Darwin was to put on a dance. The men decided that, for some reason, that since I was from Kentucky, I must know something about square dancing and hillbilly music. I didn't tell them that I didn't know anything about it, but I thought, well, there are ways of finding out. And I learned there was there were a number of musicians there on the Navy base, and they did know how to play hillbilly music, and they did know how to play for square dances. Also, I was lucky enough to find out that one of the musicians could call square dancing and was willing to take it over. So I learned from him a few of the figures and the dances, and went ahead and we set a date for it. I invited all the Red Cross girls and some of the Australian WACs who were situated close by. There was quite a large group of Australian service people, both men and women, not too far. So we did invite some of the service women, and they came. We had on the basketball court a light set up. This was outside. And we had our first dance, or my first dance up there, which the fellows decided it was a success. I often wondered about it. But we got through the night steaming. I had never attended a dance or had anything to do with so much physical effort up in the tropics where Darwin was situated. After 5 minutes of dancing, everybody would be soaked. Their uniforms just sticking to them, but didn't stop anything. Things went on and we just muddled through. That was the beginning of a number of dances, not just for the naval base, but the other groups around would have dances and would invite two representatives, that is two men, from each of the other, the bomb groups, the air depot group, the Navy group, along with the Red Cross girls, to their dances as representatives from these different units. Also, there was a 86th General Hospital, which was about 5 miles away from Darwin, and they would have personnel invited from there, and the Red Cross girl from there also. And also, I was able to continue with my treatments for my ears without too much trouble. I learned how to shoot a gun for the first time in my life. Some of the men decided I should learn how to use a .45 revolver, and they had a practice area not too far away from the clubs or from the rec halls, and they took me out there on several occasions, and I learned. I don't say I ever became good, but at least I overcame my fear for firearms. It seemed like I was destined to have trouble with clothes and uniforms all during my stay in the Pacific. My Foot Locker, again, was a little late in arriving. It just had not come on the same plane that I came in, so I got it about 10 days later. It was shipped to me. But also, I had some clothes that were taken off of a clothesline in back of the cottage where four of the Red Cross girls were based. And we used to do our laundry and hang them out in the backyard on lines that were strung up between the house and our outside facilities. There were no inside plumbing to take care of the restrooms, the toilets. That was at the back of all the yards of all the houses where the officers and Red Cross girls were based. But our backyard was used as a shortcut between the 49th Air Depot Group and their rec hall and the movie area where all the Army people were shown outdoor movies at night. And I'm sure that some of those men walking through depleted the clothesline. Also because among the missing pieces was a bathing suit. And one day on one of the beaches close by, I saw an Australian girl wearing my bathing suit. I, of course, didn't say anything. I didn't want to embarrass her, and I never would have found out who was responsible for it anyway. So I just sat there and gritted my teeth and requested another bathing suit, some more underwear from home. The Navy base was not too busy a place, and the enlisted men spent lots of time in the rec hall. I put in about 12 hours a day by putting in morning hours, taking 2 hours off in the middle of the afternoon when most people did take a siesta of some sort because it got so miserably hot, and then coming back and being there until about 10 o'clock at night. Among some of the recreations that they had were outdoor movies for the Navy also. And on the nights they had the movies, I could tell in advance there were going to be a movie because my chairs out of the club start disappearing. The boys would deke them out one by one and use them that night, bring them back the next morning because they had otherwise to sit on the ground or some hard wooden benches. I got accustomed. First, it upset me, but the chairs always came back, so I decided I had to accept this way for them. The rains came about the middle of December in Darwin, and I soon found out that the Red Cross issued raincoat was not good for tropical storms. So I got a hold of a GI raincoat and managed to live. And as far as uniforms in Australia went, it was mostly GI clothes because there were mosquitoes up there, and it was very muddy at times also. The weeds were high. The seasons were wet and dry there. And in the wet seasons, things just grew up beyond your imagination. In the dry season, all these things would be cut down, and some control was tried for the mosquitoes and the insects around. But in the daytime, you could wear your sleeves rolled up. These were olive drabs uniforms that we were wearing from the regular Army type of shirts, and sometimes culottes, and or even shorts. Of course, the shorts in those days were not the short shorts. They were the long, just above the knee type thing. But we wore GI shoes for the most part, the lace-up type, because that was the only practical thing for Darwin. And in the evening, though, we had to button up the shirts at the neck and at the sleeves, be sure that the shirt was tucked in and to the our pants, because we had to wear pants at night to cover up our ankles, and socks that would also be a help to cover up the feet, and because of the mosquitoes and because of the danger of dengue fever and malaria. Darwin was the only place in Australia that was bombed, and where there were buildings that were razed and torn down and bombed out. There were some shelters or some pill boxes that were built along the beaches also to prevent any landing there. The Japanese, of course, were the enemies that they feared, and there never was a landing there, not in any great numbers of any sort, but they did they were bombed from the air and also from ships off the coastline. The beaches were nice beaches to look at, but they were not safe to swim from because of the stingrays that were so bad up there. So periodically, I would find trucks that would transport the boys to a lake. And it was about, 20 miles inland. And it was called Micah Beach. And there was another beach that was called Casuarina Beach. But we did not swim off of Casuarina Beach. We would have picnics down there. And that's where the pillboxes mostly were built. And we would go up and take pictures around those, and it's quite a point of interest. The boys based there were not very friendly at time to visiting crews. These ships would come into Darwin, our submarines, and the crew, not having been there before, the crews were released for land leaves, supposedly, but they didn't know that there was nothing in Darwin for them to do. They would come in their uniforms, their dress uniforms, and looking spick and span, and walk down the streets of Darwin to find nothing but a few wrecked buildings, farmer restaurants, hotels, banks, and such as that. They kept on going. They would eventually come to one of the bases, either the Army or the Navy, and they were always directed to go on to the Navy base. And eventually they came to the recreation halls. When they walked in, they were a disappointed group always, and the boys who were based there regularly would sort of rise up and didn't like this invasion. But after a time, we had amicable relations because we discussed it, that is, the boys who were based at Navy 245, and I and some of the commanding officers discussed it, and we decided that we could help those crew members by being hospitable to them and extending any facilities we had. We even got to the point that later on we got together competitive type of games. We had picnics together. We took the visiting crew members to the lake inland, and we also usually managed to scrape up enough food for a picnic lunch. And that way, we had some fun times together and patched up the feelings that there had been originally when outsiders appeared. One group that came to Darwin and for whom I had to plan something to get their minds off of their job was a group of, quote, grave diggers. These men had been at Adelaide River, which wasn't too far from Darwin, and they had been digging graves for men who had died out in the Pacific and had not been interned permanently anywhere. And Adelaide River had been declared as a regular burial place for American service people. So we had special movies for them. We had special games. We tried to get special eats for them. And we collected over a number of months some instruments, and musical instruments, that is, that the boys themselves could handle anytime they wanted. And so we had jam sessions, and it proved to be a helpful time for these so-called grave diggers. End of side two, tape one, for interview of Virginia Emmerich.